Hey, good evening, or good afternoon, or good morning, depending on what time you're listening to this. It's 8 p.m. where I am, Eastern Time. And if you're listening to this in podcast, those of you in the future, isn't that wonderful? It's time travel, those of you in the future. Good whatever time of day it is. It's March 8th, 2016, and welcome to the Crystal Silence League Hour. If you tuned in hoping to listen to sports talk or political debate, sorry, that's on the other channel, but you might want to hang around anyway. Well, tonight's topic, of course, is the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha, and tonight we're going to talk about Right Intention, Part 3. And this is a very interesting topic, and Right Intention is one of the stumbling paths when we're talking about the path of the Buddha. We talked about right view last time, and I want to tell you that with every part of the path, there's always a dark side to it. If there's right view, there's wrong view. If there's right intention, there's wrong intention, and we'll be examining that tonight. So grab your crystal balls and a cold drink or a warm drink and join us in just a few minutes. Back, and I'm John St. Germain, the voice of the Crystal Silence League. That's what they offered me this job. They said, hey, how do you want to be the voice? Would you like to be the voice of the Crystal Silence League? I thought, hey, that sounds great. What does it pay? They said, nothing, but you get to be the voice of the Crystal Silence League. I said, that sounds good to me. I have nothing better to do. And for those of you who don't know, the Crystal Silence League was founded around 1917 by Claude Alexander Conlon, who was a spiritual adept, and it was designed to form a organization of people around the world who were connected via crystal balls. And Mr. Conlon would send out tonics, and these were spiritual thoughts of positive affirmation, a prayer of encouragement. And these thoughts would be received by everyone worldwide through their crystal balls. It was a network unlike anything ever seen in history. And when Mr. Conlon passed into the silence around 1954 or so, the Crystal Silence League went with him, and it laid there until, I think, 2011, when adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church brought it back to life. And now we're on the web, www.crystalsilenceleague.org, where you can find us, and you can post prayers, and prayers are always free at the Crystal Silence League. And we get literally hundreds a week, and when I say literally hundreds a week, I'm not using that as an aphorism. You know, like when people say, my head literally exploded. No, it didn't. It figuratively exploded. We don't have figuratively hundreds. We have literally hundreds per week. So first let's have our crystal of the week, which is a labradorite, which is one of the angel stones. And you can see a picture of that in our little slideshow. It's a wondrous little stone. If you hold it one way, it looks like a flat gray rock, and then you turn it sideways, and all of a sudden the light hits it, and it shines with wonderful bursts of color. And, you know, the Inuits believe that it's a solid piece of the Aurora Borealis. They do. And that's what it looks like. And it's a wondrous thing. It resists polishing. It's very hard to polish. I tumble stones, and my labradorite resisted. There's a trick to it, I learned. So you carry this. It is one of the angel stones, and it will allow your deeply buried psychic powers and potential to surface. If you're struggling with that, you have flashes of clairvoyance, the powers of prophecy, the ability to influence others, things like this, communication with spirits, and you're having trouble with it, wearing labradorite, meditating with labradorite seems to help this. It's also used for recalling dreams. You wake up and you know you dreamed something important, but you can't quite remember it. Meditating with labradorite seems to help that. It will bring out the best in you. It's your angelic qualities and help negate the worst in you, which is why I picked it this week. When we have right and wrong. It will help temper the negative parts of us, the antisocial parts, the aggressive parts. It's supposed to help with the detox from addictive substances, so it's a very good addictive stone. You're recovering from addiction. And it's a stone that's related to the hands. If you work with your hands, it will help your hands become more sensitive for those of you who are in the healing industry. So labradorite is a wonderful stone. All of our stones are wonderful. We love our stones. tonight, we're going to try to do a full show. I'm suffering with a cold, which is in my throat and chest. You know, our two-year-old granddaughter came to live with us. She goes to daycare. So you have to pardon me. And we don't have a cough button because we're not really a studio. We're, we're Blog Talk. And a cough button, if you've never worked in a radio studio, you have a button on the console. And when you cough, you push this button, and it mutes you temporarily. So, you know, when you go, you can push this cough button, and there's a moment of air silence. We do have a mute button, but it takes about 4 seconds to activate and release. So there would be this 10-second silence while I just went, so, you know, you just kind of have to live with it. And if my voice goes out, and it sometimes does, I'll just have to end the show, and we'll play some Bach cantata or something for the remainder of it, and then I'll lose half my listeners. But it's time for our prayer list. And it's been my custom since we started the show to print out a number of prayers from our, our hundreds and hundreds of prayers that are on our list. And when you go there, you see you can click on a button, and you know that people have prayed for you because you get an email that people have prayed for you. And I read these out loud. I don't ever read names aloud. I just use prayer ID. Anonymity is protected in the Crystal Silence League. So why don't you pray along with me for the following people? We have prayer ID number 48494, who's an artist and is suffering from writer's block. And so this person prays that the universe will lift this writer's block and show him or her the proper direction to go into. Prayer ID number 48493 wants better clients. This is a person who does metaphysical work and is suffering from lack of work and clients who are not appropriate to him or her, and hopes that he or she will get better clients, and so our finances will pick up. Eventually, the clients that are meant for you will find you. Eventually, they will if you persevere. Prayer ID number 48492 needs removal of curses, and has bad experiences going on in his or her life. Looks like a he, and needs removal of negative energies in his life. Prayer ID number 48491, and says her name is near the top of a waiting list for an apartment, and needs to move as soon as possible. Apparently, she's in a bad neighborhood and needs to move to this new apartment, so she needs to relocate. May she have a safe journey to her new home. Prayer ID number 48490. Apparently this is a prayer to hit the drawing for a New Brunswick moose tag. And I don't know what that is, but it must be some kind of sweepstakes. So I believe this person is praying to win this sweepstakes. So may he or she be successful at that. I don't know what a New Brunswick moose tag is, but I hope that they get what they want. I hope this is something beneficial to them. prayer ID number 48489 needs reconciliation with R and J. And prayer ID number 48488 needs some negative people out of his or her life. prayer ID number 48487 needs to keep his or her job, and prayer ID number 48486 needs steady work. Prayer ID number 48485 needs healing for a loved one, for his Aunt L, who's in the hospital in ICU. And prayer ID number 48484 needs help in relationships with other people. And prayer ID number 48483 needs healing in the heart of her husband, and he be successful and strong. And we have prayer ID number 48482, who prays that a certain person does not forget all about S, and that the relationship be healed. And prayer ID number 48481 prays for her son's health. And prayer ID number 48475, who prays that everyone's sins are forgiven. And prayer ID number 48476 prays for her car, that when she gets good news that her car is fixed at a good price that she can afford. Prayer ID number 48477 prays for successful conclusion to her son's court case, that the judge rules in his favor. And prayer ID number 48478 prays for a miracle, that TB will journey from across the seas to the United States in April. That's the conclusion of our prayers. Let's have a moment of silence for all those in need of prayer and positive affirmations. Bronchitis that's sitting in here. The topic this week is right intention, which is the second step in the Eightfold Noble Path. And if you like the old Pali terms as I do, it's Sama Sankapa. Sama means right, correct, noble, great. The Buddha was the Sama Sambuddha, the great enlightened one. So Sama Sankapa is translated as right intention, noble intention, and sometimes right thought, right focus. it is cognitive mental activity. So the way we look at this, and the Buddha explained this very specifically, and he discovered this particular aspect of thought before his enlightenment. He was striving for deliverance in the forest, meditating, and he found that his thoughts could be distributed into two different classes. In one part, he put thoughts of desire, ill will, and harmfulness, and in the other, thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. And whenever he noticed that thoughts of this first kind, these harmful thoughts, arose in him, he understood that those thoughts led to harm for oneself and to others. They stood in the way of wisdom and knowledge, and they lead away from the path to liberation and enlightenment. They lead away from nirvana. So thinking on this and reflecting on it and examining and sifting through his thoughts, he would expel these negative thoughts from his mind and just bring them to an end. But whenever thoughts of the second kind arose, he understood those thoughts to be beneficial and conducive to the growth and the flourishing of wisdom, and aids to the attainment to the path of nirvana. So he strengthened those thoughts and brought them to completion. Now this seems really simple, but it isn't. So he understood that right intention was threefold: the intention of renunciation, the intention of goodwill, and the intention of harmlessness. And the dark side of that coin, there's three parallel kinds: wrong intention, intention governed by desire, intention governed by ill will, and intention governed by harmfulness. And that the each kind of right intention is the counter to the corresponding kind of wrong intention. It's a tonic to it. It's a cure for it. The intention of renunciation counters the intention of desire. The intention of goodwill counters the intention of ill will. The intention of harmlessness counters the intention of harmfulness. This is a big thing. It's a big thing. It seems simple, seems obvious, but it really isn't. You know, your average person on the street never sifts through his thoughts and thinks this. So right intention makes the proposition, it lays the proposition before you that between right view and all the moral factors that begin with right speech, right view, and right intention, remember that's the moral factors, the intentional function, the function of intention, forms this crucial link connecting how we think with how we act. It connects how we think with how we act. Right view being how we think. Right action, which comes up in a little bit. Right intention is the crucial link. So on one side, actions always point back to thoughts from which they spring. Thought is the forerunner of action, the Buddha said, directing body and speech, stirring them into activity, using them as its instruments for expressing its aims and ideals. Thought is always the forerunner of action. So when wrong views prevail, the outcome is wrong intention, giving rise to unwholesome actions. So someone who denies the moral efficacy of action and measures achievement in terms of gain and status will aspire to nothing but gain and status, using whatever means he can to acquire them. When these pursuits become widespread, the result is invariably suffering, and tremendous suffering of individuals, social groups, and nations out to gain wealth, position, and power without regard of consequences. And this is what we see in the world today. It's what we saw in the world yesterday. It's what we saw in the world 1,000 years ago. We have seen this in the world forever. This is the cause of the endless competition, conflict, injustice, and oppression. And it starts not out there. It starts inside the mind. These are all the manifestations of intentions. These are the fruits of thoughts driven by greed, by hatred, and delusion. And if you don't believe it, just turn on the TV and watch the Republican debates and just think in terms of greed and hatred and delusion and start sifting through it and categorizing it. That's greed. That's hatred. That's delusion. That's greed. That's hatred. That's delusion. But when the intentions are right, the actions will be right. You know, the cart follows the horse. And for the intention to be right, the surest guarantee is right views, which the forerunner. So one who recognizes the laws of karma, that actions will bring retributive consequences, you'll frame your pursuits to accord with that law. That's why Buddha put so much emphasis on the idea of karma, that we are the producers of our karma, we are the heirs of our karma, and we are the people, we are responsible for our karma. Sometimes people say, you know, Buddhism is mean, it blames the victim. It really doesn't. What Buddhism says is that when we perform an action, if it's an unwholesome action, it plants an unwholesome seed, and it will grow unwholesome fruit. If we plant a wholesome seed, it's a wholesome seed, and it will produce wholesome fruit. this does not mean that everything bad that happens in the world is the result of karma. There are five factors that is taught in Buddhism that are the reason behind everything. Karma is one of them. And I can digress and tell you what those are. We'll do it after the break. The five niyamas, the order of causes, the five niyamas, and karma is one of them. Natural law is another. Seed law. We'll get into them. But karma is very important. The main role of karma dictates the why you're born, where you're born and rebirth and things like that. What if rebirth's not part of your worldview? You have one of two worldviews. You either go to heaven or hell, or you don't exist at all after birth. If you're reborn in heaven or hell, that's rebirth. And we'll talk about rebirth at some other time. Rebirth doesn't occur just after death. It recurs moment by moment, second by second, microsecond by microsecond. Everything is reborn. Consciousness is reborn. And in Buddhism, we just don't see a reason that process began at birth and ends at death. It's part of an ongoing process. And if you can get your mind around that, then by golly, you're on the way. So Buddha very succinctly sums this matter up when he says that for a person who holds a wrong view, his deeds and words and plans and purposes and actions and everything grounded in that wrong view will lead to suffering. But a person who holds a right view, his deeds, words, activities, plans, and purposes grounded in that view will lead to happiness. It's a very simple formula. So since the most important formulation of right view is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism, it follows that this view should be in some way determinative. I like that word, determinative, of the content of right intention. And we find it to be the case. So if you understand the Four Noble Truths in relation to your own life, how does it apply to your own life? Not abstractly, but how does it apply to you? This will give rise to the intention of renunciation. Understanding them in relation to other people, other beings in the world, give rise to the other two right intentions. When we see how our own lives are pervaded by this dukkha, this unsatisfactoriness, and how this unsatisfactoriness derives from craving, the mind inclines to renunciation, to abandon the craving and the addictive attachment to all these objects to which the mind clings to. So when we apply these truths analogously to everything, to other people and everything, the contemplation of this clinging and other people, it nurtures the growth of goodwill and harmlessness. We see that everyone is just like us. All living beings want to be happy. We see all living beings fear death. They tremble at the rod. And just like ourselves, they are subject to suffering. We're all in the same boat. The consideration that all beings, all living beings, the greater and the smaller, the seen and the unseen, that all living beings seek happiness causes thought of goodwill to arise. This loving wish that they be well kept, that they be happy, and that they be peaceful, free from fear, free from suffering and the causes and conditions of suffering. And this consideration, the very thought that the beings, every living thing, is subject to the suffering causes thoughts of harmlessness to arise. The compassionate wish that all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes and conditions from suffering. It all arises from that, which is a big thing. So the very moment you're reading a paperback book, listening to me ramble on, or you watched Kung Fu, David Carradine's Kung Fu, and that got you interested in Buddhism, which is really where I started back in the 70s, or something, you picked up, I still have that old paperback book, The Teachings of the Compassionate Buddha. It's an old ratty paperback book. I still have that. But the moment awareness of the Eightfold Path begins, and it calls to you, the factors of right view and right intention together start to counteract these three unwholesome roots. Delusion, which is all through Buddha's teachings, he says delusion is the primary defilement. The primary defilement of the pure mind is opposed by right view, which is the germinal seed of wisdom. Right view is the seed that is planted that grows into wisdom. The complete eradication of delusion can only take place when right view is developed to the stage of full realization, to perfect wisdom. But every flickering, every little glimmer of right understanding contributes to its eventual destruction of delusion. Drops in a bucket. The other two roots, being emotional defilements, require opposition through the redirecting of intention, and they meet their antidotes in thoughts of renunciation and goodwill and harmlessness. Now, greed and aversion are deeply grounded. They don't give up easily. They do not. However, the work of overcoming them is not impossible if an effective strategy can be formulated. So the path the Buddha suggests is indirect, an indirect path. He suggests you proceed by tackling the thoughts themselves to which these defilements give rise. So greed and aversion surface in the form of thoughts, and thus they can be eroded by a process of substituting thoughts or thought substitution. Replace them with the thoughts opposed to them. So the intention of renunciation provides the remedy to greed. Greed comes to manifestation in thoughts of desire, sensual desire, the greed of acquisition, possessive thoughts. So thoughts of renunciation spring from the wholesome root of non-greed, which they activate whenever they're cultivated. Since contrary thoughts can't coexist, try it. When thoughts of renunciation are aroused, they dislodge thoughts of desire. They just knock them out. And he talks about how you knock, remember how he said, just as a carpenter will knock out an old peg with a new peg, causing non-greed to replace greed. Since the intentions of goodwill and harmlessness offer the antidote to aversion, aversion comes to manifestation either in thoughts of ill will, which anger, hostility, resentful thoughts, or in thoughts of harming, which is the impulses, the intention of cruelty, aggression, destruction. Thoughts of goodwill counter these thoughts of aversion, aggression, destruction. It will stem that flow. It knocks them out. And in this way, you excise, you cut out the unwholesome root of aversion itself. You know, people say, how do you attack the root of these things? Well, you start at the top. You cut off the nourishment. So I want to talk to you about something now. There's a very interesting thing. When you start out doing something, you're very excited about it and very happy about it. It gives you a lot of excitement. And the Buddha even addressed this thing. We talk about dukkha. We talk about the unsatisfactory of stuff. And some people gave me some questions about this. Well, how can things that make you happy be suffering? Well, okay. I will certainly tell you that. Let's talk about some examples here. Let's say you're really unhappy right now and you look back in time and there have been times that you were really happy. Maybe you bought your first car, first time you were in love or whatever. You lost some weight and you felt really good and you felt excited and proud and everything. And these feelings are essential for your well-being, these feelings of happiness. But did they last? You have your new car and you're excited about it. You know, you're picking up every crumb of food on it. And over time, that excitement goes away. Over time, you get adapted to it. Now, this is because when a positive change first occurs, say you move into a great new house and you keep it clean and picked up, and man, this is my new house, this is great. Or you got a great new job, man, I love this job. There's lots of positive events associated with it. A new house, you're learning about the space, you arrange the furniture, you have a great new stove and a great new refrigerator and a great new desk, and everything's cool. After a while, you just don't notice these things anymore. Your new car, you don't notice all the cool things about it anymore. You become adapted to it. And all these, with fewer positive events, the positive emotions, the excitement, happiness, the thrill of acquisition, they can't be sustained. You cannot keep them sustained. And so the second reason this happiness can't be sustained, even when positive events continue, let's say that you lose 20 pounds, you got your ideal weight, and you keep it, okay, you go from 200 pounds to 180, 180, 180, 180, this becomes your new normal. This is your new flat line. This is your new normal. And as a result of this, your aspiration level might shift. You feel like you need to look even better. You say, well, I need six packs, so another 10 pounds. And this has been called the hedonistic treadmill, or the hedonic treadmill. We continually shift our standards once we've reached them, and you have to keep running in order to feel satisfied again. So the hedonic treadmill, or hedonic adaption, is something that has been recognized by a psychologist, and it's really interesting. I looked at the Wikipedia entry on this, and it talks about hedonic adaption as the observed tendency of humans to quickly return to a relatively stable level of happiness despite major positive or negative events or life changes. And according to this theory, says Wikipedia, as a person makes more money, expectations and desires rise in tandem, which results in no permanent gain in happiness. And so some people coined the term hedonic treadmill theory, which compares the pursuit of happiness to a person on a treadmill who has to keep walking just to stay in the same place. Now, this is why I don't like Wikipedia. People write these articles, and who writes them? But this sentence, the concept dates back centuries. Well, yes, it does. To such writers as St. Augustine, cited in Robert Burton's 1621 Anatomy of Melancholy, a true saying is, desire has no rest, is infinite in itself, endless, and as one calls it, a perpetual rack or horse mill. And there's no mention whatsoever of the Buddha, 500 BC, saying, restless is samsara, restless indeed, no begin can anyone see. It is a perpetual, I think he even said something like that, a perpetual walk, a perpetual wandering through life after life, no rest. Samsara itself means wandering, restless wandering. And where's Buddha in this article? 500 years before Christ, and long before Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, which is a very good reading. So the hedonic set point has been very well studied by psychologists. The idea is that you get used to a certain level of happiness, and then you get bored with it. And this is what the Buddha observed when he said, even happiness has the roots of unsatisfactoriness in it. The idea is that we get uncomfortable with things that don't change. There's cognitive changes, there's shifting values, goals change, attention changes, interpretation changes. You fall in love with somebody, there's your spouse, and over time you adapt to them and you get bored with them. Now, there is a counter to this, and psychologists recognize this, and the Buddha recognizes this. Pay attention. Buddha calls it mindfulness. Pay attention. And so I got very interested in this idea of hedonic adaptation. And I kept looking. I said, so do they recommend anything to do this and to get off that satisfaction treadmill? And yes, variety and appreciation. And basically they say change things up so that you you keep your attention interested and appreciation, which is pay attention to what is around you and be grateful for it. So basically what we have is modern psychology noticing things Buddha noticed 500 years B.C. and saying the same thing. And in one article here, I thought this was very funny. Appreciation is the opposite of adaptation. It's going out of your way to focus on something rather than taking it for granted or letting it fade into the background. So we even see the same technique of knocking the old peg out with a new peg. Adaptation, which is growing jaded with something, is a negative mind state, which you knock out, you replace with a positive mind state of adaptation. And we see how subtly these techniques of Buddhism work their way into modern cognitive psychology, either through osmosis or just people rediscover. So just remember, hedonic adaptation, that's why we get bored with pleasant things. Happiness becomes stale unless you understand that trying to cling to a situation that is definitely going to change is a surefire way to misery. So we talk about the intention of renunciation. And about this, Buddha said many times that his teaching runs contrary to the way of the world. He said it's against the grain of the world. The way of the world is the way of desire, of acquisition, of greed, of grabbing all you can. And the unenlightened who follow this way, he called them the worldlings, flow with a current of desire. You see, just look at TV, look at everything. Seeking happiness by pursuing the objects that are glamorized to be fulfilling. Cars, money. And this is, say, lottery winners. Lottery winners are euphoric, and then in a few months or a couple of years, they're back to the same level of happiness or non-happiness they were before they won the money. There is no permanent source of happiness. So, the Buddha's idea of renunciation says the opposite of that. The pull of desire is to be resisted and eventually abandoned. Quit chasing those things, because the more you chase happiness, the more it runs from you. Stand still and let it find you. Desire is to be abandoned not because it's morally evil. There's no moral evil attached to desire, but because it's the root of suffering. Plain and simple, it is one of the root causes of suffering. So renunciation, turning away from craving and its drive for this constant gratification, becomes one of the keys to happiness, to freedom from this hold of attachment. And the Buddha, and this is a mistake when people talk about renunciation, the Buddha didn't demand that everybody leave the world, the household life, and become a monk. And he didn't ask his followers to discard all sense enjoyments. And that's another thing. Say, oh, man, I got to give up pleasure. No, you don't. The degree to which a person renounces depends on his or her situation. But what remains as a guiding principle is this: the attainment of deliverance, of enlightenment, of freedom, requires the complete eradication of craving. That's what deliverance is. There are several factors. There's the giving up self-view, the extinguishing of craving, and there's a few other things. And progress along the path to nirvana is accelerated to the extent that you overcome craving. And breaking free from the domination of desire is not easy, but the difficulty doesn't abrogate the necessity. Since craving is the origin of dukkha, it's a one-on-one correspondence. It's not if and or but. Craving is the origin of dukkha. Craving is the origin of this unhappiness we feel. Putting an end to dukkha requires eliminating craving, and that involves directing the mind to renunciation. Now, the less you crave, the happier you're going to be. Will any of us achieve enlightenment? I can't tell you that. I know people do. But just at that point, when you try to let go of this craving, this attachment, that's when you start to encounter an inner rebellion, an inner resistance. the mind doesn't want to let go of this, you know, these objects to which it's become attached. And I want to tell you that we're not talking just about, you know, sex, lust, money, things. We're also talking about ideas, rites and rituals, opinions, things. You know, when you start talking about craving, you're talking about a lot of things. We hate to give these things up. Your mind really holds on to these things. You can agree intellectually for this need of renunciation. And you might say, yeah, I'd love to leave this attachment behind. But when it comes down to the reality of it, the mechanics of the nuts and bolts of it, oh, the mind rebels and recoils, and it continues to wallow in its desires. So the problem arises. The question is, how do you break these binds, these chains that desire us, that these chains that bind us to desire? He does not offer repression. He does not offer the idea of repression, and this is what a lot of people, again, they say, well, you can't repress your sex drive. You can't repress this. He doesn't suggest that. That is a psychological disaster. To repression is a disaster. Repression is basically driving away desire by filling your mind with fear and loathing. That's what repression is. And that does not resolve problems. It replaces one problem with others. And it pushes the original problem below the surface of conscious awareness, where it continues to fester away. The tool, the Buddha, and, you know, that is what occurs, by the way, in some theologies that practice renunciation. They make, you know, sex dirty or wrong. And this is why you have a lot of abuse in certain religious orders that I will not name, because sex is repressed. So the tool the Buddha holds out to free the mind from desire is understanding. Real renunciation is not a matter of compelling ourselves to give up things that we still inwardly cherish, but changing our perspective on them so that they no longer attract us, they no longer bind us. And when we understand the nature of desire and investigate it closely by paying attention to it, desire will fall away by itself without any need of struggle. That's what people will say. So you go in the monastery and you renounce sex, you become a monk, you renounce sex. That's unnatural. That's against nature. That's unnatural. Well, it becomes natural. You don't struggle with this. Now, some people do. They really struggle with it. You meditate on the nature of it until it becomes natural, and it falls away. These things fall away. I lived celibate for 5 years, and it was not that hard. And if you know me in a relationship, you know, like I am now, you know, I'm not a man who has a small desire for sex. In a relationship, I celebrate sex. But for 5 years, when I was studying and thinking about taking the robe of a Buddhist monk, I practiced celibacy, and it was not hard. My mind was not in that area. My mind was in another area, and it wasn't hard. It really wasn't that hard. I was a vegetarian. It wasn't hard to renounce meat. It wasn't hard. People, I'd die if I don't have my meat. I just couldn't live without my meat. Try it. You know, what do you mean? See, that's the idea of the mind clinging. I couldn't live without. People say it now. I couldn't live without meat. Yeah, you can live a long time without meat. You can live the rest of your life without eating meat. You put your mind in an understanding of renunciation, and it wasn't hard. I said, okay, I'm not going to eat meat, and then that was it. I wasn't going to do it. And you know, who am I, a saint? I'm Saint Germain, not a saint. And Saint Germain is definitely not a saint, I'll tell you that. So to understand this desire in such a way that we can loosen its hold, you have to see that desire is invariably bound with dukkha, with suffering, with impermanence, with unsatisfactoriness. And if you truly understand that, not intellectually, but you feel it, you know it, then it becomes a lot easier. This whole phenomenon of desire, with its cycle of wanting and gratification, depends really on how you see things. So we remain in bondage to desire because we see it as our means to happiness. That is the only reason we hang on to it. That's the only reason. And if we really understand that desire does not lead to happiness, if we really understand that, then our perspective on it changes, and its force will be abated. And that's a good move toward renunciation. So what's needed to alter this perception is something that is called in Buddhism wise consideration. And just as perception influences thought, so thought can influence perception. So our usual perceptions are tainted with unwise consideration. We ordinarily look only at the surfaces of things, and we look at them through self-interest and through craving and want, and only rarely do we dig into the roots of why we want them and why we're attracted to them, or rarely do we consider the long-term consequences. And I can tell you, as a man who's been in bad marriages, at the time, I didn't look at the long-range consequences of the short-range decisions. And to set this whole matter straight calls for wise consideration. You have to really look at the consequences of our actions, and you have to explore the results and evaluate the worthiness of our goals. And I was, you know, talking to some people about this, and this woman said, well, you can't examine everything you do. And before I could say it, someone else said, well, why not? Why can't you? And to set this straight, we have to be prepared and willing to discover what is true, even if we sacrifice our comfort. So for real security, we have to trust truth, not our own delusions. And we have to be prepared to sacrifice our comfortable illusions for truth if we want to break through and set aside this terrible thing that keeps us bound to suffering. So when you scrutinize desire closely, we find it's constantly tainted by this thing we call dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not self. That's another thing. But dukkha can appear, you know, sometimes it's obvious. Dukkha appears as pain, irritation. Sometimes it just lies as a low-level strain of discontent. But the two, desire and dukkha, are inseparable. We can confirm this ourselves by considering the whole cycle of desire. At the moment desire springs up, it creates in us a sense of lack, a pain of wanting. It can be a small pain or a large pain. And in this pain, we struggle to fulfill a desire. If the effort fails, we're frustrated, we're disappointed, we're sometimes in despair. But the pleasure success is not unqualified. We worry we might lose the ground we've gained. We're driven to secure our position, to safeguard our treasures, to expand our treasures, our territory, our accomplishments, to rise higher, to control it, to establish tighter controls. The demands of desire are endless, and every desire demands eternity. It wants the things we get to last forever. Everything has to last forever. But how realistic is any of this? All these objects of desire are impermanent, whether it's wealth or power or position or love or people. Separation is inevitable, change is inevitable, decay is inevitable. And the pain that accompanies the separation from these things is proportional to the force of the attachment. Strong attachment brings strong suffering. Little attachment brings little suffering. No attachment brings no suffering. Argue with that. Let's stop for station identification.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Arman broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times, comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
LMC. That's a C note. C. That's the key of L, I think. We're talking about right intention and why renunciation is a great thing. And I do get excited about talking about this. When I was studying for the robe, it was the monastery had a lot of Thai monks. You know, there were monks from Thailand and Formosa in Sri Lanka. And when they spoke of the Dharma to Westerners, people were, what did he say? What did he say? And they were very excited about the idea of me becoming a monk. The whole plan was for me to go out and speak of Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. And there was another guy there, and he had three teeth. He was a former street alcoholic, and he went through. I mean, man, he was Bhikkhu Ananda. We called him Bhikkhu Andy. And he was hardcore, and I had many. Someday I'll talk about all the conversations I had with him, and I'll tell you one story about Bhikkhu Andy. I was going through some self recriminations and stuff, and beating myself up. You know how people do. You know, I'm in torment. I'm in spiritual torment. You know, I'm in sensitive agony. My sensitive soul is tortured and doing that thing, and he was just watching me. He had big green eyes. He was just sitting there watching me going, He goes, what do you need? And I said, I think I need an act of redemption, some great act of redemption. He goes, He goes, John, you're more full of shit than a Christmas goose. And people, Buddhist monks talk like that. Well, Andy did. And he said, so what you do, you go out and do something, you save a life or something. He said, you think that's going to make you feel better about yourself? And he said, you know, you give your, like Mother Teresa, you go off and renounce everything and go off somewhere and live under terrible conditions and whip yourself with a whip every day. And he says, why? What will it take for you to feel that you paid off? What great evil have you done? And he said, it makes you feel important, doesn't it? That, you know, you've done this, you know, you torture your soul, and it makes you feel like you're, you know, a spiritual hero, you're on a spiritual quest. And he goes, you're full of shit. He said, just let it go, and you know, live your life. And that was a wonderful story of Bhikkhu Ananda. He's probably dead now because he was old and gnarly. But you know, he'd been on the streets, man. He'd seen people do the lowest things, and he came back from alcoholism and renounced and became a Buddhist monk. And you know, people think of Buddhist monks, they think of Kwai Chang Kane and Master Po, but they're just regular guys, a lot of them. But they wanted me to go out and talk of the Dharma and teach people, and you know, like I'm doing now. And so I tend to get sort of the Southern Baptist upbringing comes out sometimes. I become very excited and et cetera. So we're talking about the relationship between dukkha and desire. So we know that we meditate and we contemplate the relationship between dukkha, that and how it is inherent in desire. And we think that we renounce things, we move from desire to renunciation. Sometimes we imagine it's to move from happiness to grief, from abundance to destitution. But it's not. It's not. It's to pass from a life of gross, unsatisfactory, and complicated, entangling pleasures or pseudo pleasures to a type of happiness and peace that is sublime. And it's to pass from a condition of servitude to desire, to one of self-mastery. And desire ultimately breeds fear and sorrow. Ultimately it does. Renunciation gives you fearlessness and joy. You cannot take away anything from a man who wants nothing. It promotes all three stages of the threefold training. It purifies the mind and conduct. It aids concentration, and it nourishes that, remember that seed of wisdom we were talking about, it nourishes that. The entire course of practice from start to finish can, in fact, the road of enlightenment, the road to nibbana, can be seen as a process of renunciation. Ultimately, the relinquishing of all foundations of existence. The last thing you relinquish is self. Actually, you relinquish self anywhere. You relinquish self itself, clinging to self, and you have relinquished all foundations of existence, and you've reached nirvana. So when we methodically contemplate the dangers of desire and the benefits of renunciation, we gradually, you don't have to force the mind, you just contemplate. That's what right understanding is, contemplate and understand. You don't have to force it. You don't have to fear it. You don't have to look at this as putting your hand in the lion's mouth. Contemplate the dangers and the relationship between desire and dukkha. The mind will gradually, on its own, steer itself away from the domination of desire. And attachments are shed like a tree sheds its leaves, just naturally and spontaneously, when the time is right, when the season is right. The changes don't come suddenly, but when you practice persistently, there is no doubt that those changes will occur. And through repeated contemplation, one thought knocks away another, just like that new pen knocks away the old pen. The intention of renunciation will dislodge the intention of desire, and that is what right intention is all about. Next week we talk about the intention of goodwill, and how goodwill opposes the intention of ill will, thoughts governed by anger and aversion. And just as in the case of desire, there are two ineffective ways of handling it. And one is to yield to it, you know, to express it, you know, by bodily and verbal action. And of course, the other is to repress it. And so we'll talk about that next week. Do a little contemplation of your mind states and your intentions, and go out and do some good in the world. I love you all. I love you all for coming here and listening to this and giving me the chance to have a platform for this. We'll be talking about crystals and crystal balls later on this month, and how you can work some meditations into that. We have just a little bit of time left, and I think what we're going to do is listen to just a little bit of soothing music as we go out.